Hello. Welcome to Science in Africa, a Nature Careers podcast series. I am Akinjimo, Chief Editor of Nature Africa. I work and live in Lagos, and I'm passionate about promoting science and public health journalism in my native Nigeria and across Africa. In this series, we explore the practice of science in this wonderful continent, the progress, the issues, the needs, and in the words of the African scientists who are based here. In this fourth episode, we speak again to Professor Oyewale Tomori, a Nigerian virologist who is well known for his media commentary of the COVID-19 pandemic. He previously worked for the World Health Organization and now acts as government advisor on disease outbreaks. So, how did Africa respond to the coronavirus emergency?
The epidemiology of COVID in Africa is different from what is happening in Europe and other parts. That's number one. And I think we should have recognized that before we planned our response. Unfortunately, as always with Africa, we were depending on the West to guide us on what to do. But I must say that both the West and all of us were totally ignorant about COVID. Nobody knew what we were talking about. We were gambling. We were just acting on the spur of the moment. We were running after the epidemic. We make our response based on what information we have. If it changes tomorrow, we change our response. And Africa was following gullibly, just like that. But yet, we were dealing with two different epidemics. Because of certain factors, population dynamics in Africa, and all that kind of thing. So whatever disaster was happening in other parts of the world was not that pronounced in the African region. But then our approach should not have been like what it did in Europe, but should have been according to what information we have on our own.
So there was varied response.
Sure, it has to be, but we didn't. What happened, ideally, we should have looked at that environment, decided our response. But if you remember at the beginning, everybody locked down, whether you're in Africa or wherever. Did we really need to lock down? Well, I don't think so.
Yeah. Bandwagon effect?
Yeah, effect. That was it. But it was bandwagon in which the leader was as equally as blind as the rest of us. So it was the blind leading the blind. And that's where we are with COVID today. And you can see what is happening with the vaccination. Yeah. And the vaccines are coming up. We knew when you get a vaccine, you get protection. But nobody counted on variants to mess up all of the whatever you built up with your vaccination.
So what has been the response to COVID in Nigeria?
One of the greatest errors that I keep saying we made was to assume that it was the government that would control the epidemic. It's not the government that controls the epidemic. It's the human being, you and I, that control the epidemic. Forgetting is like taking the public out of public health. That's what happens. And so you sit down at the headquarters and decide, oh, that we set up a committee. This committee will look at it and say, go and blah, blah. Forgetting that there's a human aspect of it. The movement of the COVID vaccine, of COVID virus, is from man to man, not from government office. And if I get if I obey those things and get the COVID and I don't spread it to you, it dies within me. And therefore, we don't have epidemics going on. I think we should have stressed that the more important player in the COVID epidemic was the public, not the government.
Well, you know, at the initial stage, I mean, we know of lockdowns, palliative, and the number of countries becomes majorly corruption, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. What would you say has been done well? You know, looking at all these varied responses, what have we done well?
Well, at the global level, I must place kudos to WHO in respect to what people are saying about that. WHO was flexible enough to adapt its response based on the data that was available. I mean, it wasn't a dogmatic thing that this is the way you do it, this is the way you do it. You remember when COVID started? Now you look at the clinical symptoms and all the signs and symptoms of COVID. It wasn't what we had when we started from the Wuhan. Now other things have been added. So people are learning along as we go. I think that flexibility will probably be the most sensible thing that we ever had, you know, to then look at it and say, look, this is what we, you know, there was a lot of argument whether it was aerosol transmitted or wasn't transmitted by aerosol and all that kind of thing. And then, so response was based on all those ones. So back to the situation in Nigeria. I think the first thing that COVID did was to expose the flaws in our health system. You know, like when we started, NCDC said we had only three, four laboratories that could diagnose COVID in Nigeria. Yeah. Why should that be 60 years after independence? That's the question we'll be asking ourselves. Yeah. Quite agreed that COVID eventually, I mean, NCDC eventually screwed up and we had like about 140 laboratories. But then you want to also see what was behind the building of those laboratories. Did we actually need all the 140 laboratories that they built up? Or could we have done with fewer, better money than we're getting? And the reason I'm saying is that if you go back to NCDC, their website on a daily basis, you find a page with list at least 40 to 50 laboratories that are no longer reporting.
Oh, even now?
Yeah, even now, on a daily and regular basis, every week, go and check their website. They will give you a list of 40 to 50 laboratories that are no longer reporting. So why set up 140 if one third of them are not going to report a few months after you started? These are some of the things about our planning that we need to look at. Did we really plan properly? How many laboratories do we need? Could we have done with fewer and improved the access of the laboratories to the states? Yeah. Those are things, you know, that I hope we're learning from what, but unfortunately, many of the African countries, once the epidemic is over, we forget whatever lesson we learned, and then when the next one comes, we start all over again from scratch. And my worry is that now it's only 40 laboratories at NCDC that are not functioning. In another, if this epidemic continues, more will join and won't report anymore. Even right now, if you look at the figures of yesterday, only two or three states are reporting. I think we had 8 cases, 10 cases or something of that nature. Not because those are the cases, but it's a measure of who and who is testing.
And now we have the National Center for Disease Control in virtually every country across the continent. We also have the Africa Center for Disease Control, Africa CDC. Will you say that these are meeting the expectations so far for the continent?
It's a good thing they were set up, but it is not setting up, it's the operation. I would rather have an African Center for Disease Coordination than disease control. We should leave the control of those things to the lowest level, to the local government level, to the state level. And then at the apex, we have a coordinating body, not a controlling body. And there's a little difference between that, because when you are the controlling body, you are now putting all the burden of the 36 or 7 states in the country on your head. If you are coordinating, then you are only dealing with all those issues about at the different levels that require your assistance. If we decentralize the control to the lowest level, local government, state level, then our national centers, our African regional centers, will be in a position to assist, to coordinate. Where are their flaws? Where are their problems? This is what you'll be looking at, not taking upon themselves the issue of the controlling themselves. And I think this is one of the lessons I think we need to learn from what has happened. I'll give you a good example. You remember there was a time when Nigeria imported, I think it was monkeypox, into America. The discovery and all this season was done at the county level. That would be their local government, our local government. Yeah. The diagnosis, whatever, was done at the local government hospital level where it happened. The only time they ever came to the American CDC was when it involved international travel. Because, these were coming from this place. What plane did they come by? Who were the passengers? Yeah. All those kind of things. That was when the US CDC came in. But all of the little, this everything diagnosis was done at the local government level. And by the time they finished that one, they were able to control that one. And that's the message I'm trying to say, that we don't need National Center for Disease Control. We need a National Center for Disease Coordination.
You know, there's this school of thought that Africa has done well when it comes to response to HIV, response to Ebola, and a number of other infectious diseases, response to polio, which you are, involved in largely. But how has Africa performed when it comes to public communication relating to COVID-19, testing and treatment, research in itself, how has Africa performed, you know, when you compare, when you do a comparative analysis between, you know, response to those other diseases and COVID?
You set your own standard for what is doing well. If it took Nigeria 40 years to eradicate polio, I'm just giving that example, yeah, and it took other countries 30 years to do it or 20 years to do it, will you say you did well? I don't know. I mean, that's what I'm talking about, this thing. The faster we're able to get this thing, I mean, how long, you remember the setback we had with polio? I mean, when we boycotted vaccination, we did all that one. And then you jump up at the end in 2020 and say Nigeria did well.
So boycotting vaccination is at the local level? That's
that was at local level, but it became gradually a national thing we had to solve. But then, so at the end of that, you jump up at 20 and say, we did well. What about during that period of boycott? The number of children that got infected with polio because you boycotted. So when we talk about doing well, I think it's a relative term. That's number one. As to doing well with the other issues, you know, I think one of the greatest problems that we had with COVID, I'll tell you, you know, when COVID started, outside interpretation for Africa was that it's going to be a disaster. We are going to have dead bodies on the road. You know, I mean, if they couldn't handle Ebola, and this is happening in Europe. I mean, imagine what would happen in the state of Africa. So at the conceptual level of the African, it was like, COVID is going to kill all of us. Then we didn't see anybody dying. And then the interpretation was that...
Why are we not dying?
I will talk about that. But then the interpretation of that was that COVID is a hoax. Because we're not seeing a dead body. So when you now say, I'm going to die and didn't die, I'm sure you're a liar. Now you tell me, come and take the vaccine for what I didn't die of, and I'll say, you're a bigger liar. And so these are the issues that come up. Exactly, we come in. Now, why didn't we die? It's a combination of so many things. If you look at the people, check who are dying in Europe. They're the elderly people, 50 years old, who have comorbidities, diabetes, hypertension, whatever. Who are the people getting infected in Africa? Look at our own population pyramid. The majority of us are below 50. Young, energetic people, both in Europe too. These are the people who are asymptomatic. So unless you test them, you won't know you have.
So we are not doing enough testing.
Yeah, we're not. Now, that's what I'm saying. But I'm asymptomatic, so I don't know whether I have it. You're not testing me. But remember when testing started, it was, we didn't have the reagents. It was what they gave to us. And so you had to maximize whatever you had. The only way to maximize that, let's limit it to all those who are sick only. Or maybe closest relation, contact of that person who are sick. So that's why we were testing. And so we're getting 20 instead of getting 200. Because we're not testing those who are asymptomatic, who are going all over the place, spreading the disease all over the place. You know, those are the issues. So when our figures were lower, it's not really that the figures are low. And in fact, it's been proven. When you look at the cell surveillance that was done after every wave, you find the numbers jumping up. It started with about 20% in Lagos at that time. The next second wave was 40%. The last study we did was about 70% of the people we tested had antibodies to COVID. Where were they getting it? So they were infected, but they were not dying. So I think these are one thing. So immediately that concept of death was associated with COVID, and we did not see death. So this was the problem, and that's what has happened. And that's why I was saying that it was left for us at home to sit down and look at our data. Should we have approached it the way they said lockdown? Let me give you a good example. You say keep safe distance. In most of our areas, in the slums of Africa, where the rural people are living, 12 people are staying inside one room. Are you going to do safe distancing? But yet, in our own environment, we don't have offices where everybody is under air conditioning. We are out there in the open, in our marketplaces. You know, so why are we not looking at that and say, instead of Europe that is locking up because of the people who are congregating their air conditioned office, is it the same situation of my market street where the sun is there, air is blowing and scattering whatever it is, infection that may be there?
Compared with Europe and the US, the COVID-19 pandemic resulted in far fewer deaths in Africa. The reasons are multifactorial. First, demographics. Elsewhere, most mortality occurred in the elderly, when in Africa the average age is much lower. Then, climate. it's possible that more temperate zones didn't suit the virus. And then genetic explanations and generally better immunity to disease. It could also be that deaths were underreported. But as Professor Tomori says, there was ripple effect of early lockdowns that could also have played a major part in saving African nations from more serious consequences. In Nigeria, like many other countries in the world, the pandemic exposed flaws in the health system and faults in the way that national government reacted to these unprecedented events. Next, I asked Professor Tomori about how science can or should contribute to the pandemic policies.
Is there an implication in that in terms of our research advice, you know, to government on what to do? You know, are we contributing in that line in a way that government will do a policy that will say, yes, this is the way we are going and is backed by research?
We're doing research for the world, not for ourselves. Although we are part of the world, we're neglecting the part of us in our research. Everybody is doing the exchange. Everybody is doing whatever, this and that, all over. So which we must test this thing. Are there other things in your own area that are actually preventing COVID? Well, we're making lip service to that kind of research. Simple thing like I just mentioned. How easy is it to spread COVID in an air-conditioned office as compared to outside there? Those are the kind of things we should be looking at. And then so that we provide them and address our government. Should our government have lockdown? It should come from us, our research, not from what they're seeing in Europe. It should come from us and say, look, we have looked at it, that there was no need for lockdown. If you do this one, rather than say lockdown, we say avoid areas where there's going to be congregation of people, like churches, like parties, like all those things. If you put an emphasis on those, that, okay, don't go to big parties because you know you can't keep. I went and start dancing and start singing. Forget it. You cannot wear your mask. Yeah. Therefore, those are the areas we should have isolated.
Is it possible for us to lock down, you know, the continent in terms of not letting people come in? Because there was a point that certain countries were noted that should not come, I think, to the US and so on. Is it possible for us at the African level, at the African Union level, to say that, yes, this is happening in Europe, in these places, don't come?
The decision to lock down is a country decision. It cannot be a continental thing. Every country must look at its own situation. I mean, for example, it's not everybody coming from, let's say there's a problem in India. Indian people don't go to every country in Africa. Therefore, each country will look at its own and say, look.
Local response.
Yeah, local response. Mm-hmm. And that's it. So we can't really have a continental approach to that. Yeah. Each country must do its own and look at their own situation and say, look, don't come from here or go from here. Otherwise, even South Africa, we normally let them come into our place.
There are other emerging infectious diseases, you know, coming up in the future. Are we prepared?
No, we are not. I mean, you know, from what we are seeing, we are not. And I'll give you, you see, well, maybe we're learning a few lessons slowly, like DR Congo. They're doing well with Ebola. They're managing repeated. If Ebola occurs in Guinea, well, we're lucky. At the time, there was a second case of Ebola in Guinea, and they perform creditably well. But the longer interval between epidemics, the more we relax and the less prepared we are. I think we need to get that information to our people that the liberty from epidemics is eternal vigilance. You have to, it's not a holiday thing. We go on holiday from surveillance. We can't dare to do that.
So liberty from epidemics is
eternal vigilance. Yes.
Wow.
So that means, you know, you the only way you can is that you are constantly in your surveillance is in place. Your surveillance cannot go on holidays. It has to be a regular thing. Now, unfortunately, the side of it that the world doesn't understand, if your surveillance is good and there's no epidemic, then they don't even see what you're doing until the epidemic comes. But then, we don't want to wait for the epidemic to come. See what happened with COVID and see the way the world was thrown in disarray. By the time you lose that, and then I also say one thing, global health security is anchored on national health security. If, I mean, epidemic don't start all over the world at the same time. It starts from a place. Where it's going to start off, I don't know. Therefore, each country must prepare as if the epidemic is going to start from you.
So just like in treatment, you know, the referral system, you know, from the local, you know, to the secondary, then to tertiary, then to specialist, and then to even global.
So the starting point must be as strong in surveillance as the highest level.
Do you have hope that Africa can respond to public health crisis in the future, especially when it comes to response to diseases like COVID that requires vaccine?
I mean, I have to have hope. We all have to have hope. Otherwise, we give up. And it is the hope we have that is making us to talk what we're talking now. That where do we go wrong? Why can we improve? Because whether we like it or not, whether we have hope or not, the epidemics are there. The pathogens are there. They are there to infect us. So it is the hope we have that we do well that pushes us to do the right thing. We must continue to have that hope. The only person that should be hopeless is the one that is dead. Of course, he has nothing else to hope for. But each of us still alive, we must have hope that we can do better than we did last year. Otherwise, I would not be, I mean, see the generation of my parents, what they were able to do. I used to give a good example. The house that my father had, where he housed all the his harem and the 300 of us, is that the house I want to inherit?
How many of you?
No, just second. You
know, no, I thought 300.
No, the official number of those survived is about 37. But you know, in those days of childhood mortality, we must have lost almost the same number.
So it was like Solomon.
Yeah, close to that, you know. So the point that I used to talk about is this: I'm not going to look and want to inherit my father's house in Elisha. Nor are my children wanting to inherit where we are now. Because right now they even have a better place than I have. Nor would their children want to inherit even their own house, because by that time things would have been better. That is the hope we have. And we keep pushing on and say, look, you know, things must be better for the future generation than for me.
Can Africa produce its own vaccine locally?
We are.
Looking at all the innovations and other experiences from the past?
No, we are. Okay. It is sustainability that is the problem. Where you have different governments that have different opinions, that have different policies, and you cannot sustain what you have. You're not building up on what you have. That's what is happening.
Are there examples of African countries that are producing?
Let me even start without going too far out of Nigeria. There's a veterinary research institute in Vom. They've been producing vaccines in 1924. What happened? How did they do it? Yaba was producing vaccine years.
That's in Lagos.
Before. Yeah, in the Lagos one. Until we had changes of government and all that. Because why didn't the change of government affect Vom? Those are the questions we should be looking at. What did they do to be able to maintain that? That's what our scientists and researchers should be looking into. What lessons do they have from this?
Vom vaccine is for
animals.
Animals.
It's animal vaccines. Okay. But there are other countries that have been producing vaccines before. You know, Senegal have been producing yellow fever since the time I knew them. For a long, long time. They are still producing.
Which country?
But Senegal. But if you look at the behind that, and I keep saying it, and that's the thing that when you say it, people say we have no community of people. Without the Institut Pasteur being involved in what is happening in Senegal, they probably won't be producing vaccine today. So why? Yeah. What is the Institut Pasteur doing that we need to do here?
Yeah.
A few other countries in Africa, in the northern parts, they are much better than us. Yeah. Tunisia, Algeria. I mean, see what they're doing. They're much, you know, much better. Let me put it that way. They're producing vaccines, maybe not the same type of vaccines.
Yeah.
South Africa is doing well now. So let's hope in Africa. But then the greatest error Africa will make is for each country to start producing vaccine. Because we're not able to control the market. And unfortunately, 4, 5, 10 years ago, there was an African Vaccine Manufacturing Initiative, which had actually gone around and said, look, on regional basis, let's have vaccine production in Africa. Not every country producing vaccine.
Okay.
Tunisia, you produce X. Senegal is already producing yellow fever, so keep producing yellow fever. Nigeria, you produce X or Y. We will all buy from you. So when we need that yellow
fever,
exactly, then you buy from us. So every, you know, so that way, sustainability is there. So all of Africa's needs for yellow fever vaccine will be sourced from Senegal. You know, all of Africans, whatever Nigeria is producing, will be sourced from Nigeria. Then those things are viable. And Africa can be self-sufficient in every vaccine. But at least 1, 2, 3, 4. And when you have something, when it comes to negotiation, then you can negotiate. Yeah. If I have X vaccine and you have Y, then we can use that to negotiate. I don't have vaccine, you have Y. You can tell me whatever condition you want to sell your own because I don't have anything. Take the example of what happened when Britain decided that, you know, they had these rag, red, amber, green, you know, for bringing people into Europe. And the rest of us who were using COVID, which they didn't make in Europe, were in the red zone. I mean, we couldn't go into Europe because we're using COVID made in India. So what did Africa do? Africa went to Britain and accused them of inequity, or racism, all that. What did India do? India said, me, I have COVID. COVID, what is their own shield? COVID shield. You have COVID whatever. If you don't take my COVID shield, I won't take your COVID. Britain capitulated. And the following day, the rest of us who were using COVID began to ride on the Indian train to London. So, you know, this is the thing. You have to have something.
Yeah, you need to have something, yeah.
You know, you can't go to a negotiation table with nothing. When you go there with your raw materials, you get a raw deal. When you get you bring nothing, you get a nothing deal. That's it.
So there is hope.
There is hope. There has to be hope. I keep saying, I should not be talking to you if I have no hope. And we should not be discussing what we're discussing if there's no hope for us in Africa. There has to be hope. But it is the human being who makes sure that that hope is translated into reality.
Thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure, sir.
If I was to take one piece of advice from this conversation, it would be liberty from epidemics is eternal vigilance. There's much work to be done to avert another health crisis, but it seems the will among African scientists, such as Professor Yewale Tomori, is there to improve national and pan-African policies for the future. Now, that's all for this episode of Science in Africa podcast. I'm Akinjimo, Chief Editor of Nature Africa. Thanks again to Professor Yewale Tomori. And thank you for listening.